Hello and welcome to the Telecoms Takeaway. Welcome to our second episode in our ongoing series focusing on the changes to the Electronic Communications Code, which have been brought in by the Product Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act 2022, or the PSTIA. In today's episode, we'll be taking a deeper dive into the changes that have been implemented to date, how these might operate in practice, and the potential impact this might have on code operators and landowners alike. So my name is Tom Bumstead. I'm an associate director in our property disputes team. In a reversal of our roles in the previous podcast, my colleague Chris Dent will be taking his turn in the hot seat to talk us through some of the key changes that are now in force. I'll start by asking Chris some questions, and then for our next episode, I'll be back in the hot seat.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for having me on. It's great to be on for my 5 minutes of fame.
So, thanks for joining us, Chris, and I'm looking forward to taking a closer look at what these changes actually mean in practice. So just briefly recapping the provisions that have already been brought into force by the PSTIA in terms of changes to the code, there's been changes to the rights to upgrade and share, changes to the power to fly lines, national security and code rights has a specific provision dealing with that. There have been changes to interim arrangements pending code rights on renewals. And there's been an update to the ADR and the complaints handling process. So we won't have time to go through all of these in detail. So we've cherry-picked a couple of these to really focus on. So let's start by looking at the power to fly lines. Chris, it'd be helpful if you can talk us through how these provisions operate and look at the effect in practice.
Yeah, of course. So I think, first of all, to understand these provisions, it's helpful to first look at the explanatory notes behind the legislation and what these say. So I won't talk through all of these, but just looking at the kind of the headlines of these notes. First of all, the purpose of the power to fly lines was to essentially facilitate upgrading sharing of ECA kept by the main operator on land, and to allow the main operator to fly lines over third-party land. It also allows another operator or a third-party operator or sharer, which I'll call the sharer, to install and keep lines on apparatus by connecting to the main operator's equipment, and also to enable them to exercise the same rights as the main operator over the other neighbouring land. It was envisaged by the legislation drafters that the main use of this or these provisions will be for telegraph poles. So quite a narrow use already was envisaged for these. Now, turning to the provisions themselves, it's difficult to explain by reference to a kind of certain scenario where there's not much case law. And it is worth mentioning that if these provisions seem quite convoluted and complex, it is because they are. So in essence, the existing provisions in the code allow the main operator the right to install and keep lines over other land adjacent to or in the vicinity of the land or land on or over which its original apparatus is kept, provided it's connected to apparatus on the occupier's land. So the other land in this situation being third party or neighbouring land to which the original apparatus is kept by the main operator. And it's worth noting that these provisions only apply to apparatus on or over land. They don't apply to apparatus under the land. So the new provisions on top of this existing provision insert a right for the sharer or other operator with the consent of the main operator to install and keep lines over neighbouring land. Hopefully you're still with me on this. And looking at this right, it was commented by Falcon Chambers that this is essentially a right for a main operator to grant a subway leave to another operator. So hopefully that's a helpful picture of what this provision allows. Now, it's not clear from the drafting or the provisions whether the lines of the other operator have to follow the lines of the main operator's lines. But looking at the drafting, it would seem it doesn't. So this means that the sharer can connect to the main operator's apparatus and fly its lines over completely different land to which the main operator's lines are running. So over the other neighbouring land that did not originally have lines flying over it.
So Chris, just picking up on that. So is the case that the operator can can fly lines over third-party land then?
Yes, so in a completely different direction to the main operator's lines. Yeah. So a complete, separate third party who has no apparatus over their land will now, could now potentially have apparatus over their land.
Okay, I think that's a helpful, point to note, isn't it?
Yeah, and this also potentially leaves a situation where a main operator can give consent to the sharer to fly lines, but also the neighbouring landowner can then serve notice under paragraph 40 of the code to remove the cables, as there's no agreement in place. So whilst the main operator can consent to this cable being flown over third-party land, that third-party landowner can then, like that, also apply to remove it. Then move into the other parts of the provisions. So as well as the right for the another operator to share the apparatus with the main operator, we then have a new right for the main operator and the sharer to have a right to upgrade and carry out works to the lines that are installed. Now, for the sharer, it must have the consent of the main operator to upgrade and carry out works. Then for both the sharer and main operator, they must then also obtain the consent of the occupier's land on which the original apparatus is kept to access the land by the main which the original apparatus is kept by the main operator. So there's two levels of consent here: one for the sharer to get the consent of the main operator to upgrade and carry out works, and then for the sharer and main operator, if they want to upgrade or carry out works, to get the consent of the occupier's land who on which the apparatus is kept, consent to access to do the works. And then,
so
for
Chris,
both,
just to check, yeah, would that apply to in that situation you were talking about before, where lines have been run over third party land? Presumably it would be the consent of the third party land.
No, so in the instance where we had the telegraph poles, no, the third party landowner's consent is not required. Only where, say, the telegraph pole is on the occupier's land, they only need consent of the occupier whose land the telegraph pole is on, not the consent of where the lines are going to go.
Okay, I think that's helpful.
And then once they've managed to get the consent of the occupier, then for both, the upgrade works and the right to carry out works are not authorized unless they pass the three-stage test. And this test is essentially the same as in paragraph 17 of the code for sharing upgrading. So firstly, the works or upgrade cannot have more than a minimal adverse impact on the appearance of the land or apparatus. And then secondly, it cannot have a more than minimal adverse impact on the land which the apparatus is kept. Then, if they pass the first two stages, if the works or upgrade would cause damage or expense to the person with an interest in the land over which original apparatus is kept, these works cannot go ahead. So in short, we have one, for a sharer to install and fly lines over neighbouring land, it needs the consent of the main operator, but those lines can be removed by the neighbouring landowner serving removal notice under the code. Then for both the main operator and sharer to carry out works or upgrade their equipment, one, the sharer needs consent of the main operator. Then both need the consent of the occupier of the land on which the apparatus is kept, and not the consent of the neighbouring landowner where there is no apparatus. And then both the works or the upgrade must pass the three-stage test. And the explanatory notes support this is intended to be the case. So if the works don't pass the test, they're not permitted. So also a point to note here is that the consent required by the main operator, or the consent required by the sharer from the main operator, and the consent required by the main operator and the sharer from the occupier for access, is not qualified or subject to any reasonableness. So the refusal, it seems, cannot be challenged. But the drafts and the explanatory notes have suggested that the consent would not be subject to the formal requirements for agreements in the code. So if consent is given, it's a lot more easier to document. It could just be verbal.
Yeah. So as you say, it can simply be a verbal permission. It doesn't need to satisfy the condition for a code agreement, i.e. that it be in writing, as with more formal arrangements. So basically, looking at the, you know, at flying lines over neighboring land, you, as you say, you need the consent of the main operator. And if, you know, and so, and that consent isn't subject to any requirement of reasonableness.
Yeah, quite right. So it just leaves potentially a lot of hurdles for the main operator and sharer to jump through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a useful summary of that right. Thanks, Chris. So where do these changes leave the relevant parties then?
I mean, so if that wasn't complicated enough, the provisions, where we are left is we have a scenario where, absent any agreement by the main operator or refusal of the occupier of the land on which the apparatus is kept, the other operator or sharer is left in a position where it will even need to apply under the code to install and keep lines. And then separately, where the main operator and sharer have been able to install and keep lines, both operators, if the occupier refuses access to land, potentially needing to apply under the code against the occupier to access the land to carry out any works or upgrade their equipment that's on the site. Then on the other side, we have the neighbouring landowner whose consent isn't required in any of these circumstances, even though the sharer can, it seems, fly lines over completely different third-party land to that of the main operator. However, that is balanced with the neighbouring landowner having the right to remove the apparatus under the removal procedure in the code. So to top it all off, once all these hoops, consents, conditions have been jumped through or met by the main operator or sharer, a neighbouring landowner could simply remove the apparatus by serving notice, as there's no formal agreement in place for these rights, potentially saved by the main operator, who may have a code agreement with the occupier of the land on which the original apparatus is kept. And on that note, we could also be left potentially in a situation where the main operator has a code agreement which allows sharing with a third-party operator, but these amended statutory provisions could override the contractual sharing position by requiring the sharer to obtain the occupier's consent, even though the agreement itself does not require it. And all this is meant to make it easier for operators to share apparatus and obtain rights. But it seems these new provisions consist of complex drafting and a number of hurdles for a sharer and other operator to jump through, including the main operator, before they can obtain the rights they need or face being left with no rights at all. So I consider there is a risk that these provisions may only lead to confusion. I certainly can't see how they make it easier for operators to share rights and apparatus on or over land, which is a strange one given this is one of the main purposes of the code. So I think, summing up in my view, although no agreement is required to install and fly these lines and upgrade and carry out the works, this is a process which presents too many blockers for operators and sharers. I don't see these rights really being used that much by either the main operator or the other operator, particularly given the risks of removal by the neighbouring landowner at any time. It's likely to be much safer and give the operator or main sharer more certainty to obtain these rights from the occupier through a formal code agreement by requiring the rights under the usual method in the code, giving you the certainty of that contractual agreement. So I think overall, the balance of this provision has been tipped in the landowner's favour and prioritises the landowner's rights over the need for operators to install, keep, share, upgrade and carry out works in respect of the apparatus over land.
Thanks for that insight and detail, Chris. Like you say, it'll be interesting to see whether operators will in fact utilise these rights, given all the hurdles they have to jump through to share, and particularly without a formal code agreement being in place. And for those operators which actually do, how the difficulties they might face in obtaining consent or fending off removal applications from third parties. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So now let's look at interim arrangements pending code rights. Chris, can you tell us some more about those provisions and the significance of them?
Yeah, certainly. So Unlike the provisions for the power to fly lines, these are a lot simpler to explain. There are no explanatory notes in this section from the drafters to assist, but these are a lot more straightforward, so it was likely considered not to be needed. In short, these provisions allow for an operator and site provider to apply to the court for an interim order during the procedures for renewal or the termination of a code agreement to change either the consideration or terms of the existing code agreement. And when considering the application by the site provider or operator for interim changes, the tribunal can use its discretion to order the amendments changes to take effect from the date of application, which is actually probably more useful for operators. And in making the order, the tribunal must take into account a number of factors, such as the terms of the existing agreement, the operator's business and technical needs, the use the SP is making of the land, statutory duties imposed on the SP, and the amount of consideration payable under the existing agreement. But it does exactly what it says on the tin. It allows a site provider or operator to make changes to the existing agreement during the renewal or termination procedures initiated under the code.
Thanks, Chris. So where do you consider the balance of this change lies then?
So it's worth noting that site providers already enjoyed a similar right under the code to apply to the court to determine the payments of consideration pending the termination of an application for renewal or termination. And I'm not aware of any cases or situations where a site provider has actually exercised this. So I think this change is most certainly likely to benefit the operator and to be used by them tactically to obtain a lower consideration earlier during the renewal process, particularly where a renewal might be dragging. It may also be used to obtain rights, sharing rights or upgrading rights before a new agreement has been reached to carry out maybe significant or important upgrades of technology on their sites. However, the ability for operators to utilize this interim right will hopefully mean we see site provider and operators engaging a lot earlier and hopefully reaching agreement more quickly on the terms of an agreement, particularly with the threat of an interim order to amend the terms of the agreement looming over them. So hopefully this is a positive change for renewing sites. Now, in terms of the termination side of agreements, I do have some interesting thoughts on how these interim rights might be used, but it may best to see how it plays out in practice.
So, keeping your cards close to your chest on that one.
Yeah, very much so.
Did you want to flesh out those thoughts a little bit, or keep them up your sleeve for a future episode?
Maybe a future episode or future cases.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see how that. Like you say, it's a new change, and we'll see what impact it has. So, thanks, Chris. And I think that brings us to a close for this week's episode. That's been really useful, and like you say, an in-depth focused look on a couple of the key changes that have been implemented. Shame we didn't have time to scrutinize the other changes in more detail. So to recap, we've looked at how the new provisions relating to the power to fly lines work in practice, the complex challenges involved with utilizing those rights, and the difficulties that could be encountered by operators in obtaining them, and the potential restrictions on their use. So we've also looked at the introduction of interim arrangements pending code right renewals for operators and site providers to amend the terms of existing agreements during that renewals and terminations process under the code. And we've also briefly touched upon some of the tactical use that can be made by the operators. So until next time, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you again next week for part 3, where we'll be looking at some of the key changes brought in by the PSTIA that are yet to come into force. If you're interested in discussing any of the topics covered in the podcast, please do get in touch.